Hey folks, this is To Know the Land, broadcasting from the Treaty Territories of the Mississauga of the Credit on 93.3 FM at the University of Guelph. Maybe you're listening to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It's a show about our relationships with the land base, how we learn about the land, how we defend the land. My name is Byron, and today's show is inspired by some animal sign that I saw recently. As some of you know, I was just participated in my second tracker certification North America evaluation, or cyber tracker evaluation, up in Durham, Ontario, hosted by EarthTracks. And I did one in September, got a level 3. That's sort of like a 90% and up until 99.9%. And I got another level 3 this past weekend, which is great. I was aiming for, you know, professional 100%, but level 3 is great. I'm not sure where in the 90s I got. My evaluator was Daniel Hanchi. And they suggested that we don't ask for the numbers. If we wanted them, we could get them. But they suggested that maybe we could go without, sit with that, sit with our levels, and work from there. I really wanted to know my number, but I decided I'm going to take this lesson as part of the whole evaluation and just take the lesson of maybe I won't sit with that and deal with it. And I think, whatever, I appreciate it. And the best thing I can think about for the level 3, not being professional, not getting professional, is that it's a reminder that my previous level 3 was not a fluke. I am a relatively good tracker. I can recognize my track and sign relatively well. And that's a nice thing to think about. That's a nice way to conceptualize this level 3 for me and not feel hard on myself. And it was nice because other friends got higher levels than they wanted. Some friends maybe not, I don't know. But I am excited that, you know, this process, we learned so much in the process of getting to break down the tracks that we're seeing, challenges me to look at things differently, to remember to walk around the tracks, not just look at them from one angle, change my perception and my perspective, which, you know, extends far beyond tracking. But one of the most interesting finds that we saw related to earthworms. And I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to that one. But it got me thinking that I know about earthworms. I know that they're non-native species. I know that they're harmful for the forest landscape in North America and in the Great Lakes region where I'm based. But I don't know much more about earthworms. They are so ubiquitous that I take it for granted, or I just assume that they're always there. And I don't know very much to anything at all about earthworms. So I decided I should do a show to start going through some of my materials and research and share about earthworms. The problem with that is I may have a wall of books here of all sorts of natural history topics, but I have found 3 books in my collection that mention earthworms, or at least mention it in the indexes, or the indices. I don't know what the plural is anymore. And have any detailed write-up about earthworms. So I'm going to be using those 3 texts. I might draw from some papers online that I found as well. But I don't know where to look. I actually don't know where to start finding information about earthworms. And I feel like that's both potentially a fault, but also a bonus. Like, here I go. Here's the very beginning of this study, this dive into earthworms, which is going to take a long time, and it'll progress for the rest of my life. But I'm stoked. Here we go. Here I get to start learning about earthworms, which I'm really excited about to practice and get to know a little bit more. So maybe you know a lot about earthworms. Maybe some of this information will be quite advanced or quite basic, pardon me, for you. And maybe you are quite advanced in your knowledge of earthworms. But mine is so limited, very basic, like, oh, that's an earthworm. Oh, I can make out an earthworm trail in the mud. I know they come up in this, like I see them more often after it's been raining a lot. And I think that's because too much water infiltrates into the soils and they find it hard in there. And so they come up. And I know that many bird species like robins or woodcocks consume a lot of earthworms and people use them for bait, for fishing. But then those bring up so many questions. Why would native birds be eating non-native species? What's the attraction? How do we get more birds to do that? We can't get it, but whatever. And then there's aquatic earthworms. And are they in the same class? Are they organized in the same family groups as the invasive earthworms here in North America? And I just don't know. And so I'm curious. And so I'm going to start with some texts and see what I can find. And hopefully I can find some useful knowledge from this. So I'm going to start with, where's this book? Eastern Forest by John C. Critcher and Gordon Morrison. It's one of the Peterson Field Guides, a field guide to eastern forests of North America. And if you're keeping track, it's number 37. This was published in 1988. And it's a pretty good book that I go back to learn about local ecologies in eastern forests. And it has a nice section on earthworms. Earthworms are without question the best known soil animals. Members of the phylum Annelida, the segmented worms. Their segmentation is readily visible, and their musculature permits them to both contract and lengthen, allowing them to burrow effectively. Charles Darwin, in his last major work, demonstrated how effectively earthworms loosen and aerate soil. In 1881, Darwin estimated that English pastures contained approximately 23,000 earthworms per acre. Earthworms are most numerous in soils that are either neutral or slightly alkaline. They are much less common in acid soils. They favor soils with high levels of calcium, where they can be abundant as 300 to 400 per square meter. However, most forest populations rarely exceed 100 per square meter. Often called night crawlers, earthworms forage in the cool of evening, coming to the surface of their burrows to feed on decaying leaves. They have a definite preference among leaves, preferring those with high sugar and high nitrogen levels, low CN ratio. Alder, birch, sugar maple, ash, sycamore, and elm leaves are preferred. Beech and oak leaves and pine and spruce larch needles are the least appetizing. Earthworms are hermaphrodites, meaning that each animal has both male and female reproductive organs. This condition is quite adaptive to creatures living in dark soil, foraging random burrows. It ensures that when by chance two animals meet, they can mate. Earthworms lay eggs in tiny cocoons, and there are many different earthworm species, and it's not easy to separate them. Great little introduction to earthworms. Eastern Forest by John C. Critcher and Gordon Morrison, part of the Peterson Field Guides, Eastern Forest, published in 1988, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, maybe not even the Harcourt at the time. Okay, from that we can understand they're non-native. It didn't even mention that much. They aerate soil. They prefer certain leaf types over others, high sugar content, They don't like beach. They don't like acidic soils. They prefer calcium-rich soils. They lay eggs in little cocoons, and they're hermaphroditic. Biology 202, once more. Here we go. I love it. I love it. Okay. And there's a section in a different book that I wanted to read. Did I bookmark this? I did bookmark this. This is from Nature's Year, Changing Season in Central and Eastern Ontario by Drew Monkman. It's a really good phenology book. It just talks about what's happening throughout the year. It's published in 2012 on Dundurn Press in Toronto. And Drew Monkman still writes, used to write a column for a Peterborough newspaper, and he's written some other books. And I think when I first saw this book, I wanted to have Drew on the show, but I wasn't doing this show when he wrote the book. So I felt a little bit reluctant. But someday I will have Drew on the show to talk about this book and other projects he's working on. Maybe he's writing another book someday soon, and I'll get to find out about it. That would be great. This will talk a little bit about earthworms and some of their problematic behaviors that occur in North America. So again, this is all just part of a greater introduction to earthworms and how we might understand them in the context of the Great Lakes region of Turtle Island, North America. Worms literally eat their way through the soil by ingesting both organic and inorganic material. In this way, dead leaves are converted into rich feces known as castings. The partially digested leaf matter is thereby rendered much more susceptible to microbial breakdown and to increased nutrient release. Worms also mix the different layers of soil and aerate it through extensive tunnel systems. There is a problem, though. Ontario's earthworms are actually non-native, invasive species from Europe and Asia. Our forests developed in the absence of these invertebrates. Studies conducted by the University of Minnesota and forest managers have shown that these invasive earthworms are causing considerable damage. Without worms, fallen leaves decompose slowly, creating a spongy layer of organic duff. This duff layer is the natural growing environment for native woodland wildflowers. Invading earthworms eat the leaves that create the duff layer and are capable of eliminating it completely. Big trees survive, but many seedlings perish, along with many ferns and wildflowers. It is important to never dump unwanted worms, such as those used as bait, in the woods. Again, Nature's Year by Drew Monkman. On Dundurn Press, 2012. So, I want to know more about this. They're breaking down the soil material, or the leafy material that would create the humus later, that mass for these seeds to land on and start growing, soft and easy, almost maybe not yet soil. And maybe soil is. Kind of compartmentalized. You can tell certain layers of soil. I remember this in reading about forensic sciences of looking at how when people bury bodies, they can tell about soil mixtures. Certain levels of soil belong in certain areas, and when those soils are mixed, they can be red, and that's how you know certain things have been dug. Maybe if you're burying a body or something like that. So it's tracking. That's why I know what it is. Okay, it's tracking. That's why. So maybe these soil mixing can cause a little bit of instability in where certain seeds can grow, maybe. Maybe that's why it's not so good. Maybe certain minerals are only accessible at certain layers, and then it becomes clayier. But then, I don't know. I'm not sure how this all works. And like, I'm not a soil scientist. And perhaps I know some that I should reach out to and learn more about earthworms and find out more about soil science. Because I know that's such a big part of understanding carbon sequestration in soils. And do Do earthworms release more carbon? I feel like they would, because they're breaking things down, probably releasing carbon dioxide. And then are earthworms, non-native earthworms, supporting climate change, like creating more, like not as much as humans, and it's not as a big thing to be worried. There's other more pressing issues of what's causing climate change than earthworms. But I just want to know, are they playing a part in that process? I'm curious to know. So something to look into, and maybe to invite a soil scientist onto the show to find out more. I actually just paused my recording because I wanted to check if I have any more books, because I have one more book in front of me about that can detail some more information about terrestrial earthworms, but I don't think I have any more here. And I feel at a loss for that. It's so strange. If you have any suggestions for more resources on earthworms, please send them along to knowtheland@gmail.com or at @knowtheland on Instagram. That would be really helpful, because I would love to learn more, to read more on earthworms. I'm going to find some more papers. I even found a PDF online of a book. So I'm going to look into that and just try and figure it out. The book is Biological Invasions Below Ground, Earthworms as Invasive Species, edited by Paul Hendrick. So I'm gonna look into that a little bit more, but again, I don't have much here, and I think it would be helpful. I'm going to get into some of the signs that we might find of earthworms. And this is what really instigated the whole thought for the show, was the sign that I saw at the tracking evaluation. And when I get to that part, I'll let you know what it was that I saw. But this isn't it. And this is about those cocoons that they lay their eggs in. So I thought this would be important to learn about. This is from Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates, A Guide to North American Species by Charlie Eisman and Noah Charney on Stackpole Books. It was published in 2010. I go back to this book a lot. I like this one a lot. So I would endorse it again. Tracks and Sign of Insects by Charlie Eisman and Noah Charney. Look it up. Stackpole Books. Earthworm, Lubricidae. Earthworm eggs are contained in smooth, round, brownish cases, which are deposited in the soil. The covering originates at the swollen band possessed by adult earthworms, called the clitellum, Latin for saddle. After the worm mates, it produces a sheet of mucus that covers its body from the clitellum forward. Next, the clitellum produces a leathery, proteinaceous sleeve, which the worm then works forward. As the sleeve moves along the worm's body, it collects the worm's eggs, and then the sperm its mate has deposited, finally sliding off the worm's nose. As it does so, the open ends of the sleeves contract and seal, resulting in an oval case up to a few millimeters long, with a point at either end. The size and shape vary among species. These eggs are fertilized by the sperm inside the case. And the egg cases are about 4 millimeters each, at least for the red wiggler, those compost worms that people use. And they kind of reminded me of little grape seeds, but tiny, from the photograph here, little brown things. You could probably fit about 1, 2, 3, maybe about 9, 10, 12 on a penny of these little earthworm eggs. I've never seen them yet, so I look forward to seeing more earthworm eggs. So that would be pretty cool. But some of the sign I have seen from earthworms include those castings that I was reading about earlier. And in this book, it says the castings of earthworms can be very conspicuous. In fine, moist soil, they're extruded in a string and collect in a lumpy heap. In sandier soil, they form discrete oblong pellets, which may form piles several centimeters across. Pellets are made of compacted processed soil and thus have uniform, very fine-grained texture. The worm deposits its castings such that they conceal its burrow, and later castings are forced up through the previous ones. If you brush aside worm castings, the burrow entrance should be evident near the middle of the pile. And I've seen this. They're like tiny little globs piled on top of each other in the soil, and often like bare soil and paths, I'll come across these piles of their castings, and then literally, like the book says, if you just sort of flick the castings off to the side, you can see the holes underneath often. Not all the time, but often you can. If you know me, if you're a friend listening to the show, tell me you listen to it and we can go find some. It's pretty common. And if you haven't, well, look it up, because I bet you you'll find some. And I've been seeing it a lot lately. I don't know if it's because spring and the earthworms are more active. That must be some part of it. But I don't know if it's also because we've been having a lot of rain here recently. So maybe that's a part of it as well. I don't know. It'd be neat to figure it out. Another thing I was reading about for the earthworms is their tracks. Yes, earthworms leave tracks. I know a lot of people don't often think about that. I don't think for a long time until I started seeing them and realizing, oh yeah, that's from an earthworm. So it says, at night when it rains, earthworms come out and crawl across the ground surface, leaving trails in muddy areas. Their trails are fairly straight and have relatively round bottoms, and they're usually less than 5 millimeters wide. An earthworm that finds itself on dry sand or dust is unable to glide forward smoothly and leaves irregular, broad marks as it struggles along. So I've seen this a lot lately because as the puddles are drying up from the rain that we had a lot on Monday and Tuesday in my area in Guelph, all the remains leading to the puddles and leading away from the puddles are these beautiful, intricate, crisscrossing, narrow earthworm trails. So I've been pointing that out to my students, and my students pointing them out to me, and we've just been investigating them. And often you find worms that appear to be dead in the puddles, which I'm curious by and confused by, because I know some earthworms are terrestrial, some are aquatic, and I'd like to learn more about that, learn what differentiates them, and I may have a resource coming up that might be able to give us some answers, at least about the aquatic earthworms. But that's something I'd like to know more about. Earthworms also, in those burrows, under their castings, their poop, their scat, they leave other burrows with leaves on top. And this is something that we saw at the evaluation. It was like a bunch of leaves on the side of a bridge coming down a hill with sticks nearby and some plants growing. I think it was Manitoba maples, Acer nigundo, box elder. That's all one plant, different names. And these bunches of leaves, I think the question was like, who made this pile? And, you know, I thought Daniel Hinch was being a little bit more open to maybe like an animist analysis of the weather when they said who. And so I thought, oh, these look like just globs of leaves that have glommed together after the rain, right? It's been raining lately. It was raining that day. Is this what all these leaves in bunches are doing? Are they just collected in sort of floodwaters moving? When we've taken up the answers, when Daniel Hanchu said earthworms, I was shocked and confused because I had poked at them. I had looked at some of the leaves outside of the area where they had indicated where the question is. You can't touch anything in the area where the question is because they don't want you to wreck it or change it from how it was so everybody gets equal opportunity to look at it. So I was picking at stuff around it, and I didn't notice the holes underneath. But other people did. And then when I finally, when they mentioned this as the answer, I went up there and my friend Alistair and I, we moved some of these leaf piles and it took a second, but then we saw underneath there was this perfect burrow, just like a wormhole. I was like, oh my gosh. And then someone behind me, my friend Alexis, was like, yeah, I was pulling at them and I was looking at them. And then I saw an earthworm underneath sink back into its hole. And so Alexis answered earthworm and got it right because of that. And I was like, my gosh, I should have just taken more time to look more clearly. I didn't get the question right, but I'm okay with that because it was such an interesting find. It was such a cool thing to see. And then I realized when I got back to Alexis's house that in this track and sign of insects, there is a section on that happening. So I'm gonna read a little bit about that because I want to know more and I want to share this more because what a cool sign. Probably readily available to show people if you're ever taking people out tracking or showing them or teaching them. This is a really cool sign and to start bring up the conversation of earthworms with. So it's under the section for burrows topped with middens. And a midden, again, is debris or leftover stuff that animals discard after they're done eating. If you think of like human middens of animal parts that we don't eat, like you can imagine bones from chicken wings at a bar or something like that you put on it, that's sort of like a midden. Or in an indigenous sense, or you might think like clamshells in a pile. Or I remember reading an archaeological text for an old indigenous site in my area, and they found middens of bear skulls and deer skulls and all sorts of other bones, things that couldn't be consumed. And when you think of red squirrels with their middens of spruce cones and pine cones all in a big pile at the base of a tree, these are the parts that aren't consumed. So imagine for an earthworm a burrow topped with these leafy debris. Walking through dormant cornfield in upstate New York, we became curious about some piles of debris, a few inches across, that were conspicuous because they were surrounded by bare soil. Even though we saw an earthworm retreat into the ground when we scraped aside the first pile, we did not see how the worm could have been what made it. Each pile, however, had a hole in the center like the one into which the worm had retreated, with some leaves pulled into it. Sure enough, these middens are a characteristic sign of the common nightcrawler, Lumbricus terrestris. And Darwin, in 1883, devoted an entire chapter to describing the phenomenon. The nightcrawler is an anisic species, which means that it burrows deep in the soil but feeds on surface litter. It is able to pick up smaller leaves by clamping its mouth onto an edge and larger ones it holds onto by creating suction on the flat surface of its pharynx, or with its pharynx. It then drags whatever it has grabbed down the burrow. It's said that night crawlers alone can consume all the leaf litter produced in a forest each year. Earthworm middens, however, are more than the artifacts of food acquisition. They serve to regulate the burrow's temperature and humidity. Some of the leaves are used to line the upper part of the burrow when leaves are abundant. Many more are dragged into the pile than will be used. On a forest floor, these piles are less likely to be seen than bare area like the cornfield where we notice them. But they have a clumped, twisted look and become easy to spot with little practice. When leaves are not available, earthworms gather pebbles and whatever else is around to protect their burrows. Okay. So that gives me a lead. That's two references to Darwin, but one in Nature's Year, one in this Track and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates by Charlie Eisman and Noah Turney, Stackpole Books. What did I say? 2012? I just want to read that date one more time. 2010. Pardon me. 2010. And so if Darwin, you know, dedicated or wrote a whole chapter about it, then that's maybe some follow-up research I need to do. So to find that chapter of whatever book it is that Darwin was writing about it and dig in there so I can learn more about what's going on with those earthworms. Because that was such a cool sign to find, and I was so excited by it that, I mean, why not learn more? And if you have an eval coming up, then maybe you should learn about them and see if you can see them. Again, that's page 466 in Tracks and Sign of Insects. There's another book that I wanted to read up from because it's A Guide to Common Freshwater Invertebrates of North America. So this is freshwater invertebrates. This is aquatic life forms. This is by J. Reese Voschel Jr. with the illustrations by Amy Bartlett Wright. And the publisher is McDonald Woodward Publishing Company in Newark, Ohio. And I met somebody on the banks of the Aramosa River, and I don't think I got her name, or maybe I just don't remember it, but this was years ago. And she was reading this book, this orange-yellow book, and she was learning about invertebrates. And I asked her what she was reading when I ran into her, and she said, oh, it's this thing. And I looked at it, and I'm like, this book I've been waiting for. It's got sections on caddisflies, different kinds of snails, leeches, water mites, water scorpions, bugs, water scavenging beetles, broad-winged damselflies, skimmer dragonflies, stoneflies, mayflies, caddisflies, water pennies. One of my favorite, who I might have to do a whole show on, would be helger mites or the Dobson fly larva. And it details a lot about their life cycle, how they feed, what their preferred habitat is in these riparian freshwater ecosystems. Yeah, I thought this is a great book. So if you're looking to learn about that, this is a good one. But in it has a chapter on aquatic earthworms. So it might be useful to learn more about the distinction between the aquatic ones and the terrestrial earthworms. But for some reason, they're both called earthworms. So the class is, when is this published? I don't think I said that. 2002. There's also a set of flashcards that go with it. So if you're ordering it online, make sure you get the book and not the flash, or both. I don't know. But make sure you get the book. Aquatic earthworms. One group of annelids that is very familiar to most people is earthworms. Class Oligochaetae, or Chaetae. Oh, man, someone teach me Latin. Oligochaeta. Among the approximately 3,500 species of earthworms in North America, about 170 live in freshwater environments. Different kinds of aquatic earthworms are difficult to distinguish because doing so involves examining very small structures, some of which are located internally. This guide covers aquatic earthworms collectively as a class. Some of the distinguishing features are the length of the body is usually 1 to 30 millimeters long, but maybe as long as 150 millimeters or 15 centimeters. Aquatic earthworms can be distinguished by other freshwater segmented worms by the following combination of characteristics. The body is soft, moderately muscular, elongate, and cylindrical in shape. Body consists of many similar round ring-like segments arranged in a row. Think of a worm, kind of like that. Number of body segments is commonly 40 to 200, with a range of 7 to 500 in some kinds. Each segment, after the first, has bundles of tiny hairs, chaetae, Chita? How do I pronounce that? Let me know. No suckers or eye spots are present. An explanation of names. The common name worm is derived from the Latin word for these organisms, vermis. This became verm in Old German and worm in Old English, both of which referred to serpents as well as worms. The prefix earth was obviously added to reflect their habit of burrowing in soil. The scientific name for earthworms comes from the Greek words olig, O-L-I-G, meaning long, and chate, meaning hair, or chate, meaning hair. This refers to the bundles of hair that occur along the body segments. Have you ever seen hair on a worm? I don't think I have. But I have seen horsehair worms, and they're terrifying. And I think that will be the subject of another show later on, because I could devote another show to going off about how weird the horsehair worms are. Back to the earthworms. Habitat for the aquatic earthworms. These kinds of earthworms are most commonly found in live lentic, littoral, lentic, profundo, and lotic depositional habitats. Get the book. We can go over that in another show. But yeah, if you don't know, we'll figure that out together soon. I don't want to explain it all now. But these, some kinds are benthic and lotic erosional habitats, but these are very small and usually overlooked by beginning aquatic biologists. Most common kinds live in silt and mud and ponds and lakes and stagnant pools and slow-moving sections of streams. Some live within accumulations of coarse detritus on live aquatic plants in mats of algae or damp areas at the margin of aquatic habitats. In ponds and lakes, they're most common in the shallows down to a depth of about a meter. But some kinds live in the deepest parts of lakes. The ones that live in riffles are mostly in areas of gravel or sand. For the most part, aquatic earthworms are burrowers, moving in the same way as terrestrial earthworms. They live in the upper layers of soft, fine sediment and move through this material by contractions of their muscular body wall and pushing on the sediment with bundles of hairs. Some common kinds live in vertical mud tubes with their head down and their rear end protruding and waving around. That just seems like a fish lure, you know? If I was a fish and I saw that, I would totally go for it. Yeah. Imagine there was another animal that did that, that was much bigger. It would just wave a tentacle around. Be like, come eat me, come eat me, come eat me. And then suddenly someone bites on that tentacle thing and the larger creature emerges. And I wonder if that's an octopus strategy. I'd make a very good octopus, I think. Feeding. The majority of aquatic earthworms are collector-gatherers, but a few are golfer predators. Sorry, I just thought of that bud rot from a few weeks ago. Man, that was so funny. Sorry. Most common kinds eat mud, and they burrow through the sediment and digest the organic component, the phytic detritus, as it passes through their digestive tract. Some kinds graze on bacteria, protozoa, and algae. These kinds usually acquire their food by extending a muscular tube, their pharynx, from their mouth and picking up particles with its lower sticky surface. The tube is then retracted into the mouth along with the particles of food it has picked up. A few are predaceous or on small invertebrates. Yo, worm mouths. I'm astounded that worms have mouths. I don't know. Like, why they must eat, but I guess I just haven't seen it much, so I'm still astounded, you know? Does it open like, anybody remember that comic and video game Earthworm Jim? I don't know. It was like a anthropomorphized earthworm wearing a spacesuit and would go around and fight aliens. Whatever. Breathing. Aquatic earthworms acquire dissolved oxygen all over the surface of their body. This may be enhanced by pumping water in and out of their anus and acquiring dissolved oxygen through their digestive tract. A few kinds have gills that are richly supplied with blood vessels. The kinds that live upside down in vertical mud tubes wave their body to circulate water and improve breathing. These kinds also have hemoglobin in their blood to help transport oxygen within the body. More butt breathers. So think frogs and toads and turtles and aquatic earthworms are butt breathers, breathing through their anus. Amazing. Life is just so cool. It really is so cool. The diversity of form. There is no one right way. There is no one right way. Aquatic earthworms can reproduce either sexually or asexually by dividing. They are hermaphroditic, but sexual reproduction almost always involves mating with another individual of the same species. Self-fertilization is rare. Cocoons containing embryos are placed on rocks, vegetation, or debris. Mating usually takes place in the late summer or early autumn, and most of the resulting cocoons are eaten by small fish. For asexual reproduction, cells in a particular section of the body, known as the budding zone, grow into a new worm that separates from the original body. That's hardcore. Oh my gosh, if this wasn't radio, I'd be swearing. That's amazing. That's so cool. Some kinds can enclose themselves in a cyst to endure adverse conditions, such as cold water temperatures during winter. Wow. They tightly coil the body, then produce a coat of mucus that hardens around them. They emerge from the cyst as the water warms up. Regeneration occurs from among some of the common kinds. Wait, let me read that again. Regeneration occurs among some of the common kinds. They can regenerate from rear portions of the body that are damaged or lost. The length of life in different kinds ranges from several weeks to several years. Damn! Earthworms, or at least the aquatic ones, regenerating, possibly parthenogenic. You know, they're just so cool. Again, this is a section on the aquatic earthworms, so I don't want to conflate the two with the terrestrial earthworms that I mentioned before, but still cool. And there's just a little bit more to go. I'm not going to get into the section on leeches today, but, you know, pick up this book, A Guide to Common Freshwater Invertebrates of North America by John Reese Voschel Jr., just so you know. Because aquatic earthworms are abundant and easy to find, they're eaten by many other invertebrates and also fish. However, the most important role of aquatic earthworms is probably their influence on the physical and chemical properties of the bottom sediment, especially in lakes. When they feed, they ingest fine particles that are a few centimeters deep in the bottom sediments. After they have digested the organic component, the rest of the material is deposited as pellets in a layer covering the bottom. Aquatic earthworms are usually very abundant in lakes, especially in the deep parts. Thus, their feeding results in a continuous vertical mixing of the top 5 to 10 centimeters of bottom sediment. Only the uppermost layer of bottom sediment is exposed to dissolve oxygen in the water, so anaerobic conditions can develop in the underlying sediment if it remains sealed off from the water. Some microbes are the only living things that can exist permanently in anaerobic conditions. The vertical mixing of the sediment by aquatic earthworms exposes the layer of pellets to dissolved oxygen and keeps the sediment in an aerobic condition that is conducive to a diverse assemblage of organisms, including invertebrates. Aquatic earthworms are also widely used in biomonitoring studies. The last section is stress tolerance, so like how they deal with pollution or disturbance in the aquatic environments. The best known kinds of aquatic earthworms are the long red ones that are very tolerant of pollution. These may develop tremendous populations in places where all other organisms have been eliminated by pollution or natural sources of stress. These kinds are especially tolerant of low dissolved oxygen conditions that occur in bodies of water that have been polluted with organic wastes, such as sewage. They also become exceptionally abundant in the deepest parts of lake that have little or no dissolved oxygen for part of the year because of natural reasons. These kinds of aquatic earthworms can build up to densities as high as 8,000 organisms per square meter at the bottom. In the dissolved oxygen concentration become lower, the worms extend their bodies a greater distance out of their tubes and wave around more. When the dissolved oxygen becomes practically non-existent, they become very still. There are no aquatic earthworms that can withstand the complete absence of dissolved oxygen indefinitely. Studies have shown that about one-third of the population will survive for 48 days in water without dissolved oxygen, but only a very small percentage will survive for 120 days. However, it is incorrect to think that all aquatic earthworms are very tolerant and indicative of pollution. Many are facultative to pollution, and a few are somewhat sensitive to very sensitive, especially to heavy metals. It's not unusual to collect a few aquatic earthworms in a pond, lake, stream, or river. It is only when aquatic earthworms, particularly the long red kinds, represent a majority of the invertebrate assemblage that they are reliable indicators of pollution from organic wastes. Sometimes red midge larvae of the Diptera also occur in high numbers along with aquatic earthworms under these polluted conditions. Again, this is a guide to freshwater invertebrates of North America by John Reese Voschel Jr. By the McDonald Woodhouse Publishing Company. Published in 2002. A great book for learning about freshwater invertebrates. I have an old textbook, like a small sort of novel-sized or shaped hardcover textbook on aquatic invertebrates. And it has a little bit on aquatic earthworms, but not much. And I thought this book might cover everything that that one may cover. So, again, I read from Eastern Forest Peterson Field Guides, Nature's Year by Drew Monkman, Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates by Charlie Eisman and Noah Charney, and the Guide to Common Freshwater Vertebrates of North America. And again, these were the only books in my collection that I could find that referred to earthworms. So if anybody has ideas for other books that may go in depth more than what I can cover here on earthworms, please send me some titles. I would love to know more, because I feel strange saying scratch the surface, because, you know, that's what the worms do. I only just got into it, you know, and I would love to know more about earthworms, because they are so abundant, because they're here, because they are causing damage. But I don't know how, necessarily. I don't understand it. And I want to know more about it. And so I would love resources or suggestions on how to learn more. Because, yeah, it means a lot to me. Maybe I could find someone at the University of Guelph. It's an agricultural college. They probably have someone who studies earthworms to give me some basics on earthworms. Maybe a short show on earthworm ecologies and problems that earthworms are dealing with these days, and the non-native earthworm species, like these jumping earthworms, if you've seen the jumping worms. And then someone at my school was telling me that the kids that they were talking to were talking about, like, hammerhead worms, which I know nothing about. I just imagine like a hammerhead shark with a worm body. So there's all sorts of worms. And then I would really like to do a show on those horsehair worms, because they're creepy. And when I'm spooked by something, I think the best thing to do is to learn about it, so I don't feel so spooked. So maybe that would be something I could do a show on in the future. Yeah. But if you have suggestions, let me know. Email me at tonowtheland@gmail.com. Yeah. And if you want to learn more about the show, yeah, email me, or you can go to the website, www.tonowtheland.com. You can check out the Instagram at tonowtheland. If you want to support the show, you can always go to tonowtheland.com/donate, and there's ways to donate on there. Huge thanks to Renato. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Your donation is probably going to help me buy a mic stand, because this crummy one I have in front of me has been really helpful, but it's got so many limitations. For a garbage stand, it's doing really well, but I want one like we used to have in the studio when I could go into the studio more often. And I believe with your donation that will help. So thank you so much. It means a lot to me. I'm going to send you an email about it too, because I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, and if you want to support the show, always, yeah, tonowtheland.com/donate. I appreciate it. It helps make the show better, I hope. And it helps me get this done. It helps pay for the website. That's great. That costs like $250 a year. So thank you. That's it. Take care.